Welcome to the Wild Adventures Podcast, the podcast where we get to hear people's life stories and see where they've identified adventure in their life. My hope for you as a listener is that you come away from this podcast inspired to make every day an adventure. I'm your endlessly curious host, Marlene Lowe, and my passion is in hearing and collecting your stories. Have you said yes and today? Have you taken the chance to follow an adventure or made a decision saying yes without letting the fear take you? Well, that's how Jason Perelson got to where he is today. Now, unfortunately, due to technical difficulties and growing pains, the whole interview wasn't recorded, but the story that Jason shares is far too inspirational not to share, even if it isn't in its entirety. I can safely say that this interview is one that did change the way that I've been living lately. His attitude to life is both infectious and addictive, so I dare you to say yes and sometime this week. See how it changes your life.
Yeah, no, so South African originally, and then immigrated to Australia about 6 years ago. It'll be 6 years in January.
I'm from Zim.
Oh, okay, so you're little north side neighbours. We get confused for each other a lot.
How exciting. As soon as he started talking, I was like, he's not fully Australian, not a chance.
So why? I've picked up a couple of yeah nahs and nah yeahs, but other than that.
We all get those quite quickly, don't we? So tell me about you.
Right, well, I suppose what's interesting, and you're thinking about this idea of adventure and travel, and that's kind of part of the reason I suppose I went to Australia was let's just do something else. Mm. And South Africa particularly is a fascinating country. It's a place where, so largely I left because of the usual headlines you hear about South Africa and crime and all that sort of stuff, and you want to have a safer life, so you move. Fair point. But what's amazing about the country is the culture and the people. And that I find is fascinating. So often I'll get asked the question, oh, do you miss home? And my response, first of all, is Australia is home. Where you are and where you live and where your roots are with your family is home. South Africa is where I've come from and where I've been and where I was born. But what I miss is obviously family and those connections, but it's the culture and the vibrancy and the energy. So every culture has its own heartbeat. It has its own thing that just makes it who it is. And I think with thinking about South Africa and what that connection is it this kind of, it's a cliche to say drumbeat because it brings down like, you know, visions of Marvel's Wakanda and the way they represent it. But it is kind of like that. It is kind of like this. And you would know more than anybody coming from Zim, but this deep, rich culture of people and races and faces and music and rhythm, because countries that are so influenced by so many things, and particularly ones who have finally embraced their indigenous cultures and what that means and what the connection is to land and story and history and ancestry, that they bring this all into this melting pot is amazing and it's fascinating. And I think that's one of the real reasons why travel for me particularly has been amazing. But it's also that journey that shaped me in so many ways. And fortunate or not fortunate, I tend to view it as fortunate. I was born in 1982. So really deep into apartheid in South Africa. Mm-hmm. But on the way out of it, so when I still have this distinct memory of being, I would have been eight or nine, I guess. It was 1990, 1991, when we were all in primary school in, I don't remember what normal grade it was, whatever, wherever an 8 or 9 year old is. And then we were all taken to someone's home that lived just on the periphery of the school grounds. Mm-hmm. Didn't know why, but it was all the teachers filing us off and all the kids went off and we went to someone's home. And it was one of our students in the class was home who just happened to live right on the grounds. And then we all just piled into their lounge. And we were all sitting in the lounge and the teachers were sort of back, but there was this nervous energy of things that were happening.
Yeah.
And the TV's playing on us like this box, you know, the big big old, you know, rear projection box television, and it's tiny and it's just sitting in the back. To be fair, I think the lounge was much larger in my mind as an 8-year-old than it probably is a normal lounge, but it was like vastly different, you know, over there in the back. And it was just these, it felt like there were 30 people in the room. It was probably 15, but there was a moment. And I never realized at the time, and only many years later, I could put together what we were watching. But we were watching the live release of Nelson Mandela. Mm. And that is such a shaping moment where, as an 8-year-old, you're like, oh, okay, that's interesting. There's a dude coming out and there's cameras everywhere and loads of people and the teachers are going crazy and there's an energy, but okay. And years later, as you sort of start to reflect back, and so I've done this in my career as a creative director, where my job is thinking about how to connect and influence and message and relate to people and connect on an emotional level. Mm. And the way I've kind of shaped as I've moved, which leads to then going to Australia, is this idea of the yes and philosophy. It's the idea of taking and going for it. You know, when you're faced with an option or an opportunity, rather than saying why, say why not. Rather than saying no, say yes and. What can you grow? How can you just travel through that? And I reflected on this in that Nelson Mandela was that. Mm-hmm. You know, he walked out of, 27 years in jail, put in there in the height of the most divisive, racially charged, fascist, conservative political regime, which actively targeted people of a different race to say no. You know, so growing up in 82 to 90 was just no. I was very fortunate being in a very liberal home of super lefties, all just wanting culture. And I went to a private school. So again, so privileged.
Yeah.
But I grew up with people of color who could also afford to go to the private schools. So I was a little bit disconnected, thankfully, from it all, but still surrounded by this idea of no, you know, benches that were only allowed to be sat on by white people, public toilet, bathroom, this whole society that was no and no and no and no and no. Now imagine a man put in jail for exercising his political right to say, and through civil unrest and protest and all these things, to say, this is wrong. And of course, he's right. And then serving jail for 27 years, most of that on an island in the middle of nowhere, he walks out and his first speech is about moving forward and saying yes and. He walked, so when I was watching as a child, he left the prison, which was now off Robben Island and back to where he was in the Northern Transvaal at the time, which was, it's now called Gauteng, and by Johannesburg and Pretoria. And he marched towards, I think it was the Union Buildings in Pretoria, which is the capital of South Africa, or at least the legislative capital, whichever one it is. And there's three. And there were hundreds of thousands of people there of all races just standing there waiting to hear him speak. He was still this figure. And he came up, and that was when, that very first speech was when he was talking about a rainbow nation. It's now time for us to move forward for people of any race, of any color, any creed. He could have come out and said, right, now we're going to actually protest and just take over and I'm here for revenge.
Yeah.
He didn't. And it wasn't a big political speech. He wasn't actively trying to, you know, win an election or things like that. He came out and spoke. And that was incredibly shaping for this idea of what can you do to shape the world? Because he never stopped doing that.
Yeah.
I was very, very, very fortunate. And this goes back to super privilege. I mean, like, middle-aged white dude. So I'm with all the privilege. If not for being a ginger, I would be the entire privilege spectrum. So the fortunate part of that I had was many, many years later, we had the democratic election in 1994. I think 95% of the population voted for the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela became president.
Yeah.
And he was exactly as the legends say, exactly as the myth of the man. He is that man you read about in stories, in books, and see in interviews and have people talk to him. That's 100% how he is.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate years later, they created the 46664 concert series, which was around AIDS and working towards raising funds to help African countries in South Africa and just fight AIDS. And the first one was down in Robben Island, where he was, and it was U2 and all these international artists played. I didn't go to that one, but I went to the second one. Mm-hmm. And that one was held in a golf course down the coast. And it had to be held in a golf course because of the number of people who were going.
Nice.
Hundreds of thousands of people wanted to attend 46664. This would have been 2005, maybe. So he had much longer retired. He was a very elderly man, but very active still. And he was guiding the country still. And now the concert series was hosted by Will Smith. You had Annie Lennox. You had Katie Mellower. You had a whole bunch of local artists. You had Queen were there. It was Paul Rogers, who I think was the frontman for Free. He was the sort of the Freddie Mercury role, but the rest of Queen were there. Hundreds of thousands of people on a golf course, monumental party. Everyone's having an incredible time. International artists up the wazoo, all over the place. This thing was going on from 4 o'clock until about 9, 10 o'clock. And then Nelson Mandela's coming out to speak.
Yeah.
I have never experienced hundreds of thousands of people silent.
Really?
Incredible. The actual experience that you have of him walking onto stage, where you've got hundreds, now we're way into what, 11 years of democracy. You have a beautiful, rich, cultural, multicultural crowd of everybody, of all races, ages, everything. Nelson Mandela walks on and everybody is silent. People who've been drinking since 4 o'clock are silent because that is the impact he had.
But that
is that idea of the hope and the yes and the, you know, doing things different, is to have that kind of figure. So that those are shaping moments where, for me particularly, and being able to reflect back on that, and I regularly actually talk about having experienced that, because it is such a transition point. Or Biden said something recently about inflection points. I think that's a really great example of that.
Where your inflection points.
Yeah. So, like, you know, taking that as an example, and then I think back to moving to Australia, where at the time I was engaged or just become engaged to my now wife, and I think we were driving back from a holiday or something, and she said to me, "We're going to have a family. We're going to start a family. I don't want to actually do it in this country." Mm-hmm. Because the sad reality is, over, which would have probably then been almost 10 years, even after that moment, the country had fallen into quite a deep decline, thanks to corruption and greed from a number of different political factions that just tore it apart and did not honor Nelson Mandela's memory. He unfortunately had passed in 2013.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't safe, and it remains not safe to this day. But my wife then said, I don't want to do a family here. How about we immigrate? Mm-hmm. And my instant response was, yep, let's do that. Why not? And we started to say, okay, well, if we're going to do that, what country? And we said, don't know. Which one? And you just work through the atlas, because we were thinking about not what couldn't happen, but what could.
Yeah.
And so we went through America, Canada, you know, UAE is too hot for me. I'm a ginger, I'll die. You know, it's a little bit gray in the UK, the language barrier in Europe. Sort of just running through all the lists of kind of going yes and yes, and then saying Australia. Oh, yeah, actually, you know what? Australia's not so bad. It's pretty temperate. It's kind of the same as South Africa. It's mostly South Africans now anyway.
Exactly.
So we said, all right, let's give that a go. And then we were doing some research, and I think we spoke to an agent at one point who specializes in migration, and they said, you know what, where you can go is Canberra.
Mm.
And my response, and I would imagine to most people, is, where the hell is Canberra? And I had to Google it, and Google Images, the pictures look great. And we thought, all right, let's do that. We'll go there. That seems nice. Like that. Now, they tell you on the brochure that Canberra is a nice moderate temperature of about 31. So we were going, oh, lovely. What they don't tell you is it's the average. So winter is blisteringly cold and summer is blisteringly hot. And there's an average across the year of like 30. Either way, the premise of of just going. So when we immigrated, so we said, fine, we'll do that. We went to the agent and we said, okay, we'll do Canberra. We then said, well, let's figure it out and do it on our own, and did all the paperwork and submitted all the things. And then said, we've actually spent all of our money on the immigration part, which is fine. We need to get there and do jobs and things. Like, we were very fortunate to get a permanent residency visa with a state skilled migration thing. So we could go there and just stay there.
Yeah.
So we really aimed for the big one. And took about a year and a half all in to actually get there. And then sold everything. Sold the house, sold the furniture, sold everything.
Mm-hmm.
Booked our flights, bought an inflatable mattress. And that was my carry-on in the plane.
The mattress.
Mattress was my carry. You could stuff it into like a little duffel bag. Yeah. And it was slung over my shoulder. And then I think we packed our luggage. So you could get slightly extra weight for the immigration flight. So we just packed our luggage as heavily as it possibly could with stuff that we needed.
Yeah.
Sold everything else. Because we couldn't afford to do the crates and the containers and then shipping up furniture and all that stuff. We had spent it all. So inflatable mattress on the back. Had booked a hotel up until the 31st of January, like a little budget thing. We were arriving on the 23rd of January because the 26th of January is Australia Day. So we thought, oh, that's kind of cool. We'll get there and experience that. No jobs. Said, we'll figure that out when we get there. No one wants to hire. I'm not going to be like, hey, I'm an African. I'm going to be there. Promise. It's, I might as well be a Nigerian prince telling you to send me money back by an email. So I said, we'll figure it out when we get there. And we worked out that with having sold our furniture and everything, we could live like survivor style for about 6 months. So we said, cool. So we can do rice and we can do water from the tap. We can be fine. We can do this. Good. But we'll treat the first month like a holiday. We're not even going to think about it. We're not going to think about jobs. And we just arrived. And then we landed, went to the hotel, had our stuff, and went, okay, now what? And then just adventured through and thought, suppose we're going to do this bank account thing. All right, well, okay, let's get a bank account. Now what? Oh, we need a house, don't we? Because so my two dogs, I've got a beagle and a French miniature poodle. They were South African too. They came with us too. So it was a non-negotiable. We were coming, they were coming. Like,
yeah.
So that's also partly why we didn't have enough money, because we also brought them over. And they don't have jobs and not earning money to contribute to the fees. So, so they had to come over and they spent some time in quarantine over in Sydney. And they were going to join. So they came a little bit earlier than us and they were there until sort of mid-Feb. So we had a ticking time bomb. So we were in hotel until 31st of January. Have to find house that can take two dogs.
Yeah.
And went off and found house. And we were very fortunate, incredibly grateful. We managed to find a house. Managed to go and get our dogs, managed to discover pretty quickly that the fences had holes in them, because in South Africa you're used to barred up things, whereas in Australia everyone's pretty chilled. So the dogs escaped and we got phone calls from people saying, oh, is this your dog up the road? And we're like, oh, okay, I mean, I've just got in the country, let's not lose our dogs. And you know what, we just approached it saying, we will do whatever, we're just going to keep moving forward, we're just going to say yes and. So if we don't get a job, fine, we'll pick fruit, we'll work and we'll wait tables. It doesn't matter, we're here.
Yeah.
And I'm very fortunate that I could get work. I was employed at an agency and I could continue my career, and have been very fortunate to have made a very good career here in Australia now, nearly 6 years later.
Yeah.
But I strongly believe it's because we just dove in and went very, and this is where I've reflected back to, say, Nelson Mandela and all of those things. And I mean, I'll never be even the hair on Nelson Mandela in terms of the greatness. But for that inspiration to just go, yes, and why not? Let's do it. Let's move forward. Let's not focus on what happened. Let's focus on what we can achieve and what we can change. So let's just do it. And that's kind of the story that got me here to a point.
So it's having that really proactive mindset, isn't it? And I mean, like I said, we'll never be Nelson Mandela, but it's that inspiration of people like him that make you want to make a change and want to do something that's worth living for your own life. But also, if you can live a life that's fulfilled and happy and you're doing everything you can, that will inevitably inspire someone else to do the same. And if you can just do it for one other person, then in my book, that means you've led a successful life, because you've helped one other person or inspired one other person to make something out of their lives. And that's
you are absolutely right. Yeah. Oh, so much so. I think we often focus on, you know, how big can we make a change? How much can we do? And you look at, so look at Greta Thunberg.
Mm.
So she went and sat outside of Swedish Parliament by herself. Look at the change she's made. She didn't start by saying, I'm going to have a global movement that will put me in front of the UN. She started by saying, I want to have a voice.
Yeah.
And I think that exactly what you were saying about if you can change one person.
Mm.
So let's take it back. Greta Thunberg's parents.
Yeah.
They changed one person.
Yeah.
They helped raise her to be strong and to be, you know, thinking about the planet. All of the things that went into raising her and supporting her and bringing her up. Look at what they did by one person.
Yeah.
That it's that ability to create change, and it's, you know, the change you want to see in the world and all that kind of stuff. But it is true.
It's
taking the experiences that you have, whether you're fortunate enough to travel the world, whether you were fortunate enough to see and experience different things. And if you are able to, I absolutely recommend it, because it does shift and change your view on culture and society. But even as you cross the street, even if you talk to neighbors, even as you just live and exist in the world that you're in, by learning and experiencing in every moment that you can and seeing things for what can I do? Smiling at a person, you know, treating someone who's packing your groceries in a different way, because maybe they had a terrible day and they get treated like hell because they're ignored half the time. And if you just go, thank you, what change could that do?
Yeah.
Those are all these tiny little inflection points. They don't have to be big, monumental, sweeping changes, but they could lead to the next thing.
This is where I wonder if it comes down to culture or, actually culture is probably a big part of it. So that there's two parts, I suppose, where my mind goes when I think of this. One is, what has happened in the world where we all feel like we have to make massive changes? And part of me wonders if it's the social media and people always striving to be the next popular person, the next big hit. But if we take the podcasting, for example, right? We podcast and we talk to people. But I certainly never set the goals to be the best podcaster in the UK or in the world. I was like, no, I want to hear people's stories. So this is why I'm doing it for me, selfishly. I'm doing it for me to hear stories and share them. But where is the culture? Where has it come in? Where did that change happen where every single person wants to make a living out of being famous? For me, it feels like we've stopped looking at those small changes that you can do. Everyone's looking for the big bang, but what are all the small little things that you can do to make your life rich, to help someone else, to be, what's that word? When you want to put other people first, you kind of do something out of, it's not, philanthropy is one way of looking at it, but it's that day to day, giving someone a compliment, giving a stranger a compliment. Because it'll make
me feel good.
Random kindness, exactly.
Yeah.
And the other part to it that makes me think is a friend of mine who also grew up in Africa, he was from the States, moved back to the States. And he wrote this newsletter a few weeks ago around laughing at misfortune. And he said, in the US, when people fall down, if you laugh, you're an evil bugger. Because why are you laughing at people when they fall down? But in Africa, when someone falls down, you laugh because the world has just done that to you. Like, fate has made you fall down and you just see the world from a different viewpoint. You're seeing it from lying down instead of standing up. But it's a thing to laugh at, because just as you thought you were on the right path, fate chucks it all up and makes you fall down. I thought that was so poignant. It's not something that I'd thought of before, but it is the outlook. When you grow up in difficult places, you learn how to see the beauty and the difficulty and the imperfect and when things are just going wrong. And you do find those small little things that make life exciting and where you can make someone's world different by making one small change.
Mm. That's I've not heard that story about the, you know, the falling over and laughing, but that is so powerful, and you're absolutely right. It's so incredibly poignant, because, and it makes me think about that, the social media and the, you know, how to be an influencer and how to be famous, and it goes back to what we have seen as fulfillment, which is the I want to be seen, not necessarily for fame. Fame has become the mechanism to be seen. Yeah. But I want to be empathized with. I want to be noticed. Mm. And, you know, that idea of falling down but then being laughed at, it's because that moment, exactly, I'm just going to be paraphrasing you now, but it is just this idea of that it's not a shameful thing. It happened to me. Let's laugh at the world. Let's have that release, because we share that experience. Mm. But if you're laughing with me and in a situation, I am not ashamed of what happened to me. Yeah. I don't feel it's my fault that I fell over. It is just a thing. And so this desperation for connection. And Elijah, I actually don't mind influencers all that much. I mind what they do with their influence.
Yes.
But and the social media algorithms are interesting in how they create cognitive bias bubbles, which we see. And that has influenced even more the greater need for influencers, because of I can't get seen because the algorithms make me not seen, but I crave the gratification of the attention of the likes ticking over. And even the way, anyone on Instagram, for instance, even the way they build the notification system to help you keep those surges with the holding back of early likes and then seeding them out in bulk later to give you that what is it, serotonin or whatever it is that, you know, fires the brain. I can't remember which one it is now. There's all of them. To give you that hit, it becomes a drug and it becomes an addiction. But it is ultimately down to, I want to be seen and noticed. And, you know, thinking about the African context, one of the things I absolutely love is the Zulu word, sawubona, which is a greeting, which is, I see you. It's not hello. It's not hi, how are you? It's not any of these things that, you know, we will just go, how are you? Good. How are you? Good. And we didn't mean any of that.
Exactly.
the cultural richness of sawubona is, I see you, I connect with you, I notice you, you are there, you matter. And that's what we need. I think that these are all these sort of triggers of society, which is why I was saying travel and experience culture, because all of these things we learn from, we see. We saw it recently with Van Jones, I think his name is, the reporter who went viral recently with his reaction to the American elections. And regardless of your political affiliation, his response was beautiful in that, to him. And I was very appreciative. He said at the end of that, I know that some people lost and I'm sorry that you lost, but his reaction was talking about, we matter, and for him it matters. And he talked about mattering. Mm-hmm. And that was a really, really powerful connection. One, he was incredibly raw and emotional about it. It was beautiful, and I was crying. But that idea of mattering is so, so important. I think that became a really, really valuable thing, even as I'm processing all the things in the world. And I tend to do a lot of reflecting just by default, and I've often joked that I'm basically a mirror at this point. I think reflecting is good, you know, and it is about, what are the things that we learn from each other that then shapes everything? And what are the ways that culture connects? And here in Australia, we talk about the First Nations people, and they talk about being custodians of the land, and that, you know, we pay tribute to the land upon which we stand. When we start meetings and events, and we'll do an acknowledgement of country. And if we are fortunate enough to have a First Nations person doing it, they'll do a welcome to country, where it is about, and they particularly talk about, they don't own the land. We don't own this land. We are the custodians of it.
Yeah.
And it's all of these connections to, and I've diverted way off topic. I'm bouncing all over the place.
No, it all ties in. Beautiful
cultural patternings where you think about environment, you think about people, you think about all of those things. These cultures can really connect to how we shape and view our experiences of the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sawubona through, you know, yes and with Nelson Mandela, to yes we can from 2008 to you know, the connection to land and being custodians of the land upon which we stand, and thinking about what is our responsibility as a society to the environment. We don't own the land we're on. We've inherited it as a custodian.
Exactly.
We need to be adopting so much more of these principles within ourselves to learn from the other cultures, to be more globalist than nationalist, more integrated than whatever the opposite of integrated is, grated.
Yeah.
All of those things that we can learn and grow, and why experience and why culture and why society and why all of these things are so important at a deep archetypal universal sort of human truth level.
Yeah, I think that's why I, coming back to what you're saying about culture and Indigenous people, like for me, no matter which country you're in, if you speak to the Indigenous tribes of that country, whether it's the Saomi in the north of Scandinavia, or the Aborigines, or the local tribe in Zambia, they all have that connection to the earth, and they know this is what matters, is what we're doing with the earth, with the raw materials that we have, and how do we pay homage to that, pay tribute to that, look after that, because like you said, we are custodians, we don't own it. That's a figment of our imagination. The world will go on far after we have stopped functioning or stopped being. And it's that, I think that's what's so beautiful about Indigenous people, that we need to learn from them, because they hold this knowledge, they hold this passion that needs to be highlighted and shown so much more.
Yeah, absolutely. And isn't it funny how so many of us have lost that view? If we think about, when we talk about environmentalism, we talk about fracking and oil and everything else, and we go, well, why shouldn't we? It's there. Well, let's drill for oil because it can fuel our cars. Let's do that. It's there. We'll take it. It's fine. We forget what our role could be or what might be, and how that all connects together.
Yeah.
And what we should be doing as a society, and integrating with what are the different thoughts and practices that we could actually better adopt, rather than focusing on the selfish need or the greed. And, you know, by all means, we want to be successful as human beings. We want to be creating something more of ourselves. But we can do two things at once.
Exactly.
We can, you know, build a sustainable society for generations to come. You know, the big separator from us and the animals, I suppose, is there's two things. One, we somehow are able to eat more than we need, or kill more than we want. And the last part is even weird, because me, you know, being super lefty, also vegan, all kind of feels weird to me. But the idea of that we as a species create fiction.
Mm-hmm.
No other animal does. We make up stuff. And what we realize then, we realize that we make up a lot of stuff, is that nothing actually exists, everything is made up.
Mm-hmm.
So all the rules and barriers and reasons why we can't do stuff, we made up.
Yeah.
Most things, now there's things we, and you know, the basic premise is everything is made up, but the more and more we agree about it, the more it feels firm to us.
Yes.
So we agree that the house that I'm in now, that I'm allowed to stay in.
Yeah.
But the agreement's made up. The lease is made up. Everything else is made up. The reason I got to this country was made up.
Mm-hmm.
The way I paid to get here, we made it up. You know, companies that we work for, who says they're a company at all? We just agree it is. We made it up. It doesn't actually exist. Now, and as I say, there's moral codes and ethical codes, and you know, laws are pretty good to follow, and they are grounded in the fact that they should be doing good things for good people. Yeah. But when a law sucks, you change it because you made it up in the first place. So voting rights, apartheid, segregation, climate policies, all of those things, we change. We change it when it suits us because it's made up.
Yeah.
And it's the same as saying, well, we can't do something because. Why? Why not? And
there's
that principle of the ESN coming in again. It's why not? Why can't you? You see, I mean... when I studied my degree, I did like a year of political science. So of course I'm just a political science expert because I was there for like 5 minutes. But I think I particularly hear when everyone talks about socialism and the socialist states, terrified of socialism because look at Venezuela. Largely these are all failed political systems, and most of us actually live in relatively socialist states. It's not entirely socialist, but there's a lot of socialism because anything where you get something from the government, that's socialist. If you are fortunate to live in a country that has, you know, public health care, socialist.
Yeah.
Also democratic. It's also capitalist. Any pure system of government actually fails.
Yeah. It's made up of parts, and we create the combination that works for the society, the culture that we're in. Yeah.
Correct. So and, you know, welfare and supporting childcare and supporting public schools and education subsidies, all socialist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not for one moment saying everyone just go socialist. It has in an own right, its own perils by going into one thing. But we made it up.
Yeah.
We make up the boundaries to say, well, we can't do that because I don't like it or because it seems wrong or because it doesn't agree with me. You make it up. Mm-hmm. Do things that are good for people. Do things that are good for society. And there's a great adage about kindness, and that kindness is a choice. You can be good, but kindness is a choice you make every day.
Yeah.
Which I really love. It's this idea of it being an active process where you need to choose to be kind. Exactly what you were saying, you know, earlier around that random act of kindness, about choosing to just go over and make a difference, to do that little butterfly effect moment. So let's all just make a choice and realize any barriers that we make, any reasons that we shouldn't be doing something, it's all just made up.
Yeah.
I'll give you a great example. Actually, this happened to me the other day, and I feel very proud that I did it because I have a lot of excuses myself often, just not to do something because I'm mostly lazy and if I'm hanging out. So I was sitting on the couch the other day, and I had decided in the morning, you know what I might do? I might actually go to a cafe, just read my book and have a coffee, just sitting by myself. I don't really do that, but I might do that. So I got my Kindle out and it was flat and I charged it. And while it's charging, I had the day off. And then I was sitting relaxing on the couch, weather was nice. I watched a movie and it was starting to get a bit late. And so I was saying, oh, I'm gonna wait till the Kindle's finished charging. I mean, it probably is finished charging now, but I'm halfway through the movie. By the time the movie's finished, then it feels a bit late and it's like 2 o'clock and my son's gonna be coming home in a few hours. I might just skip it.
Yeah.
And then I realized I'm just making excuses.
Yeah.
So I can pause the movie. I can go and get the Kindle. I can get up and drive to the cafe 5 minutes from now. I can spend even an hour there, read my book, come back. My son still won't be home for 2 hours. So what exactly am I doing other than living with the inertia of not just getting off my ass?
Yeah.
So I did. I went, oh, actually, I have made all of this up. So I'm going to go. I paused, got up, put my shoes on. And within a few minutes, I'm in the cafe and reading my book. I went, oh, that was actually quite nice. I enjoyed that. And I bought, you know, a tremendously decadent chai and a huge cake where the server or the person behind the counter who took my order said, are you sharing for two? I'm like, no, sharing for one. She said, cool, no judgment. And that was the day. And I felt horrendously bloated afterwards. And I had eaten far too much salted caramel. What a nice day.
So one thing that I've picked up through our chat is you're a very proactive person. You lead with yes, you take chances, and you don't let yourself get pulled down by excuses. So do you think that is why you've been so successful in your career?
Short answer is yes, absolutely. Even when I think about if I go into the pure career journey, the steps that I've taken growing my career have been based on yes, an opportunity. So I left school and went into uni. I was 17 my first year at uni.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied a Bachelor of Science degree, which I thought would be smart because that was 2000. And it was, you gotta do the computers. And I like computers. I was doing computers in my teens. That seemed like a thing you do. And my dad was super smart as an electrical engineer. So great, I'll do that. And not to mention the fact that I failed science in high school. But no, I'll do a Bachelor of Science. That seems cool. And so I went in and I signed up to do physics and chemistry and pure mathematics and statistics, and that all sounds cool. And I had giant books, and I would carry them all, and dropped out in the second semester because I was failing miserably.
Yeah.
But while I was studying at the uni, I discovered they had a little student radio station. And I was a relatively shy kid. You wouldn't know now that I babble for hours. However, at the time, I didn't really get involved in a lot of things, but something struck me and I sent them a mail. I went, okay, I'll give it a go. So yeah. I said, I think I saw something on the little student website about the radio station saying, if you want to join us, send us a mail. So I did. And they phoned and said, oh, come in for a voice test. And I was fortunate enough, and they said, oh, you know, come be a part of us. There's nothing really available now, but do some training and hang out, and it's all just students and light.
Mm-hmm.
I returned in the next year to do the degree again. Said to my parents, no, okay, cool. So I dropped out, but hear me out, I'll come back in the next year, promise. I'm going to do easier classes. It was my fault, I just picked the wrong ones. I'm going to do some easier ones, totally going to be fine. They went, okay, cool. 2 weeks into the first semester, I was like, okay, so hear me out. If I drop out now, you can get a refund. We did that. And I dropped out. And so, but by this stage, I'm hooked on doing the radio stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm going, this is really cool. I'm enjoying this. There's still no opportunity for me. But someone said to me, you know, there's a graveyard shift from midnight to 3 that no one's using at the moment. We sometimes do it for training, and they just do sort of ad hoc things. Why don't you tell the station manager you want to make that a show? Because
mm-hmm.
he had done this. This was the drive time presenter at the time telling me. So I'm like, oh, okay, cool, I'll do that. And so I said to the guys, could I have that, just make it a show? And they thought about it for a while, and I think they came back to me after a few days and said, all right, go do that. So I did. And then because of my, you know, inflated ego, I then decided that the drive time guy had done it for 9 months.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do it for 9 months.
Yeah.
What happened was it actually worked out really well for me, because 3 or 4 months into doing it, they said to me, oh, look, someone's leaving on like a Saturday morning, 9 a.m. show. Do you want to do that? And you can move to like daytime radio on the weekend.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, no, I've still got to do 9 months. On, you know, in midnight, I'm sort of, you know, 3 months in, 4 months in. I want to do the 9 months. I want to do it the longest.
Yeah.
So they went, all right, fine, you're weird, but whatever. Stick in your midnight till 3. You know, I was a student. My car was always empty. I had broken down at like 3 o'clock in the morning, trying to drive home, pushing my car down. All those student experiences. But I kept doing it. And by the time my 9 months had come over, they then said to me, funny you should mention it, because you could do the evening weekday shows from six in the evening till 9, and that's the request line. It's the biggest show on the station. Would you like it? I'm like, yeah, I'll take that. I did that for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then in that time, I learned to do producing, and I produced ads and was started to get production, and I taught myself, and I started to write ads. And they said, do you want to maybe try out with being like a account executive type? I'm like, oh, okay, I'll do that. And then I started to do my own thing and make my own ads and write my own ads, and, you know, did the show and did the ads and started to learn things and failed miserably at tons of times. I ran an event that nearly bankrupted the radio station, so I learned from that. And then that's a whole long story. But either way, they didn't get bankrupt. We solved it. We moved on. And I was fortunate enough to then get a big sale, which kind of like balanced the books again. But I kept jumping into opportunities. So then they said, would you like, years on, they said, would you like to be part of the management team? Yes. Would you like to be the operations manager? Yes. Do you want to do, you know, I would just keep going yes and yes and yes. And I started freelancing for a commercial radio station, doing copywriting for them. And every opportunity that came up, there was bulk writing opportunities where I would need to write sort of 4 a.m. and do about 45 ads that I've got to write 30-second spots in a month.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, yeah, I'll do that. That sounds fun. Let's do that. And I was writing until 5 o'clock in the morning. And I got a phone call, the ones from the commercial station, to say, we've got an opportunity here for a producer. Do you want to come do it? And I said, no, because it was actually a yes in the end, because it was actually me saying, I need to do my degree. I'm just starting. And I went back and I did a Bachelor of Arts in Media and Communications and Culture. And this is when I did political science and I did contemporary culture and society and philosophy and film and advertising and radio. And even my degree program, I picked as many different things as I could because I was interested in all things.
Yeah.
So I did economics for a while and just to fiddle around the edges. And I got an opportunity to write for a newspaper and I said, okay, I'll do that.
Mm.
And eventually I was still writing for the same commercial station that called me for the job. I was freelancing for as a copywriter. And then another big bulk round came out and I said, could I work at your office? Because I had friends there anyway. So I said, can I just work at your office? Because I don't have a printer at home and I just wanted, I had a printer at home. I was just telling them I wanted to work there because my feeling was if I'm there, there's more opportunities. I'm part of the team.
Yeah, they see you.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I worked there, did that for a while, hung out people. And the marketing manager said, we've got a role for a marketing coordinator. Do you want to do that? I said, okay, I'll do that. No idea what a marketing coordinator at a commercial radio station does. Did it. Figured it out.
And so another story shared around the campfire. If you want to share your story or join the Wild Adventures podcast community, make sure to check us up on our website, which is www.thewildadventurespodcast.com, checking out LinkedIn, Patreon, Facebook, and Redbubble. If you like what you heard on today's episode, then leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and help spread the stories. Also, if you want to share your story, then you can fire me off an email to contact@thewildadventurespodcast.com. Till next time, my wonderful wildlings, I hope you have a fantastic weekend and you have plenty of adventures to share with us come Monday morning. Bye!